if some bloody idiot stands up in front of a blackboard and talks at you, you may learn a little, but you won't know anything at the end of it. Knowledge cannot be told. You can only be shown the way to it. I will show you how knowledge is attained. Now, to attain knowledge, you can only be shown the way. So I will ask a question. Who knows what a prime number is? Hands up. You know. What is a prime number?
Well, there's some numbers which can only be divided by themselves.
Yes, yes. Right. In other words, and this is a nice way of putting it, the prime numbers are the numbers that do not appear in the multiplication tables except as themselves. That's very nice, because you have all these multiplication numbers, 6, 10 to the 60, and all the rest of it, all that bloody shit. And you're taught this wrong, of course. You're taught with all these extra words, and this dogs you for the rest of your life, because you cannot get out of the habit. And you say, well, what are 7, 6s? And the one set of children who were taught their tables like this. 6 1s are 6, 6 2s are 12, 6 3s are 18, 6 4s are 24. And this poor woman who'd been taught this way, and she had to do her accounts. And so the only way she could do her accounts was like this. You see, normal people are insane. The way we're taught is insane. Man is the only animal who is normally insane. This is an insane way to teach. And so we're all taught with this total insanity by people who are themselves insane, who themselves teach wrong, don't know anything, parrot what they're told. But parrots are more intelligent than we are. No, sorry, they're not more intelligent. They're cleverer than we are. Parrots can learn language with no accent very quickly. And in the universities, you learn like parrots. You don't know anything. You just learn to parrot it. They copy like parrots the mistakes of other academics. And so you get the same mistakes year in, year out. And always in logic, for hundreds of years, since horrible Aristotle was clever, but he was completely idiotic. He thought that women had more teeth than men. And as Russell said, all he needed to do was look in the mouth of Mrs. Aristotle and count, which he never, like so many academics, never did. We had another professor who always maintained that anybody could compose like Mozart. It's just, too ridiculously simple. And somebody said, well, why don't you do it? He said, I wouldn't waste my time. Any work of great power is always simple. Any work of art. The astonishing thing about a work of art is that the way it goes is always evident. You always know what's coming next. In the beautiful duet, La ci darem la mano. La da da di ya la da. La da 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 di la, etc., etc. The moment you hear it, you know how it's going to go. There's no other way it can go. And yet it took the greatest musical genius of all time to actually express it. And when he expressed it, we all knew it at once. And we knew we'd known it for centuries. We knew we knew it infinitely before it happened. We always knew it. And Mozart was the greatest composer, practically, of all time, because he was the only one who left you hungry for more. That duet lasts 3 minutes in an opera lasting 3 hours. And I bought expensive recordings just to have that. And it is rudely interrupted at the end by an ex-lover. And because it has to conform with the conventions of drama. Now, the convention of drama is that if two people start making love, they are always interrupted. Otherwise, you'd have difficulties, you see. I mean, you know, they get into bed together and it would all be very boring. So they have to be interrupted, because drama is not about pleasant things happening. It is about unpleasant things happening, because that is always very interesting to us. If you read the newspapers, you would realize it is not true that no news is good news. It is that good news is no news. And we're always interested in seeing people frustrated, because we all feel frustrated ourselves, and it's nice to see somebody who looks more frustrated than we are, so all we want is bad news. They're now discovering all these things, and the last thing that happened was that a prominent member of the Conservative Party, a member of Parliament, was discovered dead wearing women's knickers and a bra. And this is, of course, very good news. I mean, very bad. Well, you see what I mean. It's news, it's news. Everybody's very interested. Ah, you see, that's what they like to see. That's what they like to read. And if the news was that he never went to bed with anybody and was absolutely good, this would be very boring, wouldn't it? Anyway, where have we got to? I completely lost the place now. What were we talking about?
Mozart.
What?
Mozart.
Mozart, yes, Mozart. Yeah. Yes, he always leaves you wanting more. The only composer that does. Beethoven, who at his best was almost as good, and he's German. When he found a phrase which was interesting, he repeated it and repeated it and repeated it and repeated it. The most wonderful piece of music by Beethoven, or one of the most wonderful, he did write some very good things, is the second movement of the Kreutzer Sonata, which is pure sex from beginning to end. It is so explicit, it is embarrassing. If you don't know it, get a good recording and play it by yourself or with someone you want to embarrass. It is embarrassing. It is pure sex. It is brilliant. And Beethoven was so taken with it that he did this set of variations on it, each sexier than the last. And the thing was, Mozart never did this. He produced this, here again, you see, he produced this theme, which is a delight. And we all know it. We all know it. And the moment he says it, yes, I knew that. Of course, of course, of course. And but he leaves us yearning for more. So what has every other composer worth his salt done? He has given us more. Liszt wrote a set of variations on it. Chopin wrote a set of variations on it. The first thing he did, practically. Just giving us more of that wonderful theme. And, where were we? Yeah. Art is about what you know. There's never an opinion in art. If there is, it's bad. It's not proper art. And mathematics is art, and that's why it's so beautiful, you see. The beauty of mathematics is that it's all about what you know. In no mathematics textbook is there an opinion. Because if you only think it, it must be wrong. Because if you have to think it, you don't know it, and if you don't know it, you don't know it. And so, what these wretched, pathetic psychiatrists were doing on the television was, since they didn't know anything, they were so fucked up with their idiotic, senseless education that they thought nobody knew anything. And the trouble with these academics is that they are not scholars. I am a scholar. I have read all this. I know the books. I know what the academics have missed. I'm a better scholar than any of them. They're such bad scholars because they're specialists. They just read their little special subject full of all the mistakes of the last parrots who did it. And they don't read anybody, oh, that's not my subject. You cannot know anything unless you compare it with what's gone before. I'm not primarily a mathematician. I'm not a specialist mathematician. I'm a man who can do mathematics. What I can teach you is how to clear yourselves. But it's not something that happens straight away. Because you're so buried under mountains of rubbish, so buried under mountains of false teaching. Because not only are you taught falsely, but it is reinforced over and over again. So that even though you see intellectually what I'm saying is true, you still can't get out of the habit. You still fall back into the old ways. You use my mind while you're here because you can always use somebody else's mind as an extension of yours, and my mind is perfectly clear. And so you can think through my mind, and then you go away and you've forgotten what it was because your own mind is still stuck with all these false trainings, reinforcements of the propaganda that has been dinned into you. Which is the fact? The earth goes round the sun, or the sun moves across the sky? Years ago, when I was a student, undergraduate at Cambridge, I realized that you could describe facts any way you liked and make it perfectly consistent, even if somewhat complicated. I started with the thesis that the earth is flat. All right, people say, well, when a ship goes a long way away, its hull disappears, and you see its mast, but no hull. And then the mass disappears over the horizon. How do you account for that? Oh, obvious, obvious. It's quite clear that when light travels near to the surface of this flat earth, it bends. It bends concavely. And this is the horizontal light bending hypothesis. And And you go on like this. I mean, you know, you do the mathematics of it and everything. And yes, the Earth is flat, and all these phenomena are caused by the horizontal light bending hypothesis. And then people say, oh, well, you go a long way on this flat Earth, and you come to what looks like the same place. Ah, but it isn't really the same place. There are all these cells with these duplications. Duplications, you see. Same-looking people, same-looking countries, but they're not really the same. Now, I don't know any of you know this dream. That's the end of the flat Earth hypothesis. And you can develop it yourselves. It's perfectly. I sent it to one of the mathematicians. And he said, oh, you can't be serious. Because people think. They don't realize that whatever you have can be explained in any way by any different hypothesis, by just making the constants different and then making everything else fit in. And we have Occam's razor, which says you should use the simplest, but it may be a matter of opinion which the simplest is. And but in any case, it's not true that one of these theories is right and the other one is wrong. I mean, in the old days, the sun went round the earth and all the planets moved in these funny little epicycles. It was very complicated, but it worked. I was reminded of it in one of the hotels in New York, where every set of rooms is exactly the same as every other set, same pictures, same carpet, you know, same design, but in a different floor and a different place. And so when you get back into this hotel, you have the illusion that you've come to the same set of rooms. And it's a very peculiar illusion. And it reminded me of this dream. I'd go for a long journey, and I'd come home, and I'd find instead of the one house, that the house had been reduplicated as far as the eye could see. All identical houses. And of course, once you get there, you realize that once you go inside one of these houses, there will be duplicate furniture, just like this hotel, a duplicate mom, duplicate dad, a duplicate cat, all of which would greet you. And so the question is asked, well, what's it matter which house I go into? Oh, yes, it does matter. Of course it matters. I must go into the real one. I must go into the real one. Because what about, you know, if I go into the wrong one? Okay. So, what will this wrong mother, wrong father and wrong cat do? They will all be deceiving me. And the nearer they are to the real thing, the more wicked they will be, the more they will be deceiving me. And my own ego is not too well off either. You know, I can't be much good if I'm not able to distinguish my own mother and father and cat. So this dream is a terrible dream. It's a nightmare. Anyway, the assumption is that there is something really out there. But as we've seen, if we take away the form of words, there is nothing left. Nothing left at all. Ah, but you say, well, it looks the same to me as to you, so there must be something really there. But who is this me and you? What does every being This was the difference between a being and an existence. A being is the hypothetical being that looks through a perfectly transparent window and sees something. Doesn't matter what it is, sees something. Every being experiences this. But where is the being who experiences this? Where is the I that you talk about? Helena, where do you experience me? Where? Yes. Where do you see me? Over there, don't you? Yeah. If you're a scientist, you might say, "Oh, I experience you in the in my visual lobes." Yeah? Well, of course you don't. Of course you don't. All right. So that's where you see me. Now, what is seeing me? Something you call I. Yes? Where is that? Where is it? Where is what is looking and seeing what you think is me over here? Not what you think is me, what you know is me over here, yeah. Where is it? What? Your eye is in your eye? Are you sure? In your eye? In your eye? Where is this so-called observer? Yeah, the I. Oh, yes, you're confusing I with E-Y-E. Yeah, no, no. I mean I. Okay, what you call I. Every being experiences itself as I, even insects. I am looking through this perfectly transparent window and seeing you, it, this, that, the other. Now, where is this I when you say, "I am looking at you"? Where is it? Where? Where is the I that says, "I am looking at you"? I, you say, am looking at you. Where is I? Where? Where do you think it is? I? Don't you think it's in you? Yeah. But where in you is it? In your knee. Okay? Is it in your knee? Not in your knee. Okay. In your hand? In your head. In your head? You sure? Do you know, your head is just a meatball. Why do you think it's there? Whereabouts in your head is it? Exactly where in your head is it? In your teeth? That's part of your head. In your teeth? In your throat? In your nose? In your hair? Okay, what place in your head? Nowhere. That's better. It cannot be located. It cannot be located. And I remember once when I fly aeroplanes, and I used to fly in formation. You do aerobatics in formation. And sometimes, by mistake, my wingtip would touch the wingtip of a colleague in the plane next to me. And where do you think I felt the pain? It is very painful for an aeroplane to touch another in midair. As well as very dangerous. And pain, of course, is the image of damage. It is the fear of damage, pain. Okay, where do I feel the pain when my wingtip is touched? What? In my wingtip. Yes, that's where I felt the pain. Yes. The I is not located. My brother got rather depressed in Africa, decided to kill himself. And all he had was a bottle of aspirin. Now, anybody who contemplates killing him, herself, I don't recommend aspirin. A, they're not very good for killing. You have to take an awful lot of them, and they make you very ill and sick and so on. However, it's the only thing he had, so he took them. And after a time, he found himself floating by the ceiling, looking down on his body below in the bed, connected by this long thread, the silver thread. And he looked down at his body and said, "Poor body, it's too young to die." He went back in, recovered. So the I doesn't have to stay in the body. Doesn't have to stay in the body. Now, why does it stay in the body? Because when the baby is born, it doesn't feel confined by its body at all. What happens is, okay, it decides to go into the doorknob. And when it's gone out of its body, the body goes all lifeless. So the parents fetch the doctor, and the doctor sticks needles in and does awful things to the body, and the eye comes back in to protect itself, protect its body, to protect its vehicle. We don't have to be stuck in this bag of skin. The first thing people learn when they learn magic is how to get out. Sometimes you get out by mistake. You know, you don't know, you suddenly find you got out. And sometimes you get out when you go to sleep. And I remember I was floating around by the chimney pots, and then suddenly there was a noise, and I rushed back into my body. And I suddenly realized I got to turn myself the right way around before I went in. And Raleigh Lang said, "Ah, yes, I have a patient who is convinced that he's wrong way round in his body. Wrong way round. I had a patient who was never in her body. She kept getting into mine." And I said, "What am I going to do about this?" She used to come in every night, get in. I felt the whole difference, the whole new system of respiration, a new heartbeat, everything else all different. It was very distressing. And another doctor said, "Ah, yes. When my patients do that, I make them pay rent. I make them pay extra for wear and tear." People say, okay, I once said to somebody, "I find it inconceivable that I could have had a more than one incarnation." And he said, "Don't you find it inconceivable that you could have even one incarnation? How could that happen?" Furthermore, it is not true that the body completely regenerates his material after 7 years. It does it after two. So your body 2 years ago was a totally different set of material atoms and electrons and whatnot. You don't find it inconceivable that it's still, that you remember being in that body which was quite different material. Yes. Yes. Exactly. Yes.
Mm-hmm. How is it that is, as you had just said, that is somehow combined with an incarnation or two, but distinct incarnations and not just in a nowhere and somewhere? just to, you know, somehow rescue.
Yeah, but you see, the what could get out of the body is, of course, not material. It is the next level. It is the subtle body, you see, and which is not really the I. But the I has, as it were, gone with it. The I isn't even confined to the subtle body. The subtle body is not material, but it's very like material. This is such a big subject that I can't start it now. Well, I can, but I won't. I'm concerned with the question of where this I is located. And eventually, you see, we see it isn't located anywhere. It isn't located anywhere at all. If it can't be located, it's nowhere. It's nowhere if it can't be located. It isn't anywhere. You know, we have all this horrible philosophical question of the mind and the body, the relation. I mean, this is a category mistake. So, what is looking out? What if something can't be located, isn't anywhere? Can it be anything? What is this eye that looks out of this perfectly clear window? But if it can't be located, it isn't anybody, is it? It is nothing, looking as it were out of a perfectly clear window and seeing something. And in order to produce this kind of illusion of the same universe, the I is the arc. It is common to all mathematics. It's common to all perception. And with the illusion that we are all separate eyes, we have to have the appearance of a stable universe outside, because each is the same eye, if we do use another hypothesis. There can't be any difference. There can't be any different kinds of nothing, can there? Yes. What?
Then I agree with you. We're saying there's nothing. There's no conscience.
Yes. I'm going to. You produce this awareness. You see, there is awareness. Okay. Somebody asked Sakyamuni, "What is existence and what is non-existence?" And he said, "Existence is duality. Non-existence is non-duality." I'll read you a bit from an early introduction to some of my work. A generation has grown up since Laws of Form was first published in English. Human awareness has changed in the meantime, and what could not be said then can be said now. In particular, I can now refer to the falseness of current scientific doctrine, what I call scientific duplicity, that appearance and reality are somehow different. Since there is no means other than appearance for studying reality, they are definitively the same. But the scientist not only supposes they are different, and that he is gradually finding out the one by means of the other, he supposes also that awareness, which he mistakenly confuses with consciousness, of the reality appearance is something that is different again, and that the universe might have existed, in quotes, for billions of years, in quotes, amidst total unawareness of what was going on. This I shall have to call scientific triplicity. Again, by definition, definition, there can be no appearance. This is not an awareness of appearance. And, of course, no awareness. This is not an appearance of awareness. And since the scale of real unreal cannot apply to appearance in general, as it can distinguish, for example, between real and toy soldiers, whatever appears as appearance must be equally real and unreal. Reversing the false distinctions, we arrive at what I call the triple identity, notably the definitional identity of reality, appearance, and awareness. It's remarkable how all the building blocks of existence appear as triunions. Compare the so-called divine trinity of Christianity, which is merely a summary of our perception of how to construct the formation of anything whatever, what it is, what it isn't, and the distinction between them. It's the triunion that apparently provides the magic inflatory principle that makes it all seem like it's really there. The word there supplies the trick. There exists in reality no where for the there to be, nor is there any when. All these are constructions of imagination, inventions of apparently stable formations for the apparent appearances. Hence another expression of the triple identity, the identity of imaginability, possibility, and actuality. The universe is simply what would appear if it could. Its laws are the laws of the possible. A thing is not possible unless it is imaginable. We can never confirm that it was possible unless it appears in actuality. And the process of this was called by Sakya Muni conditioned co-production. Co-production being that you cannot produce a thing without co-producing what it is not. And the condition being that it is forbidden to be what it is not. Otherwise, it couldn't be what it is. And so you get all these triplicities, all these triple identities. The original triple identity is the identity, the definitional identity of appearance, reality, and awareness. We must remember that we have no evidence for the appearance of anything but appearance, that appearance is the only evidence we have for appearance, and that nothing other than appearance has ever been known to appear. This is the first clearance. All the answers to the great questions, life, death, and reality, are all so simple. They're all truisms. The problems are caused by the use of words. Animals don't have the problems. They don't have our complicated linguistic expressions. Animals don't need enlightenment because they've never been unenlightened. We are unenlightened by words. We are muddled up. The answers are all very simple. All very simple. And we always look somewhere more complicated. We never believe they are as simple as they are. They're all truisms. We have a grand race in Britain every year called the Grand National. It's a great steeplechase and the great high fences, and horses get killed, break their legs, jockeys break their necks, and so on. So it's a very big sporting occasion, and everybody loves it, you see. And people, even people who don't bet, they bet on the Grand National. And a friend of mine said I was going to put £5 on the favourite and £5 on an outsider at 500 to 1. And I think as I was going to the betting shop to make the bet, I said to myself, did I have any dreams? And I suddenly remembered. I dreamt that the Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition came to tea. And it was horse running called party politics. So he said, I put all my money on party politics and it won. And I said, yes. And you probably didn't realize that your dream was very exact indeed. You know, you just had the vague idea of politics, but you were holding, you know, those of you who are psychiatrists will know, you know, that you can go into any amount of detail about the symbolism and see what it means. I said, yes, the message was very exact indeed, because you were having a tea party and politics was what came to it. So it gave you the name of the horse. And you put your money on it and you won. He did. Came in at 14 to 1. So he got £140. And then he had another dream and another race. And he thought, well, it can't happen again. And the horse, the dream of the horse was absolutely obvious which one it was, and it won again, but he hadn't any money on it. Because this time he wanted it confirmed. Of course, it never will be. You have to take that risk. You will know the future, but only in an unconfirmed state. And you will never get it confirmed. And so you just have to decide whether you have properly interpreted the message, because you will never get another message. You will get no confirmation of this. But of course we know the future, but in a different way from which we know the past. And so so concerned is our education with confirmation that we have, just in the way that Western education is concerned with the conscious memory rather than the awareness memory, and to the point of absolute idiocy, because we've all lost our awareness memory, well, except me, who I've refound it. The same with, we're concerned with only with what can be confirmed, and therefore we don't regard the reality of a knowledge of the future, and which will always appear in dreams and symbolically and so on, but it is a totally different kind of reality. It cannot be confirmed ever, you see, and therefore we're taught to ignore it. But casinos know better, because casinos have to stay in business. And casinos are always afraid of drunks and beginners, because they know, and I've seen it happen, that somebody who is totally drunk can come and he can win and win and win and win and win. And why does he have to be drunk to do it? Eh? Yes, to get rid of all the shit he's been taught. He kills off all his nerve cells and gets to something more fundamental, which is in touch with his knowledge of the future. Yeah, yeah, simple as that. And beginners the same. The beginners don't know what they're not supposed to not know. You see? And so you get what's called beginner's luck. We all know about it. Only Two is being published in German, and they asked me to write an introduction to it. And it is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pages. May I read it, Fritz? May I read it? Yeah, yeah. Yes. I wrote Only Two in 1970, so it is dated somewhat. And some of the slang words in use among young people then are forgotten today. It is the last thing I ever wrote before I became enlightened. I became enlightened at 14:23 hours, Greenwich Mean Time, on 7th of September 1970 in Cambridge, England, in the front upstairs room of To the Terrace, St. Peter Street, under the shade of an impressive locust tree. I just finished the first draft of the book. And of course my enlightenment made me see it all in a new light. and I realized that what I thought was important was not. Being somewhat frugal by nature, I didn't wish to waste all the hard work I'd put into making the book, so I set about redrafting it, magicking it, that's a tongue twister, magicking it all over to make it look not too silly. What I could not disguise was that it came from an unenlightened point of view. It suggested that all sorts of things, like global overcrowding, really mattered, that don't in fact matter at all, since the world is not made of anything, there isn't anything to make better or worse. You might think then, since I was not enlightened when I wrote Laws of Form, why did I not consider that a bad book too? The answer is because the laws is the vehicle I constructed for my enlightenment, and it can be and has been used by many others for theirs. In the laws, I had proved that if a distinction could be drawn, then the appearance of all this, in quotes, what we call a universe, in quotes, would inevitably follow. What I could not see was that, starting with nothing whatever, how anything could appear to come of it. Given nothing, I could not see how a first distinction could ever be drawn. The answer came to me as I reread the place in Only Two, where I likened the ultimate reality to a kind of infinitely sensitive photographic film. I realized that the only thing, in inverted commas, i.e. non-thing, that would be sensitive enough to be influenced by a stimulus so weak that it didn't exist, was nothing itself. That is, nothing is the only thing, inverted commas, that is so unstable that it can go off of its own accord, the only thing sensitive enough to be changed by nothing itself. So, if nothing could change nothing, we have inevitably the appearance of a first distinction. And the rest, including the ineluctable appearance of all this, inevitably follows. For years I was ashamed of Only Two because of its unenlightened view. But when Bohmeyer had the vision to ask me if they might republish it in German, I reread it and was surprised to see how well written it actually is. It may not be entirely enlightened, but it does treat a difficult subject sensitively and simply. It is also very funny. Because remember that languages were never produced by conscious thought. They were the automatic occurrence of awareness. And this awareness is, of course, much more discriminating than conscious thought. We can think of Freud here, you see. Freud called awareness the unconscious. Now, a medical student who was in my class, who became a surgeon and is now a psychiatrist, Tom Farewell, once said to me, only once, he said, "The unconscious is not unconscious. It is just that the conscious is unconscious of what the unconscious is conscious of." Now, when something is exactly right, you never forget it. Well, you never forget it if you're using your awareness memory, which I've trained myself to do. Because the awareness memory is perfect. And you don't lose it over time. And languages are made through awareness. They are recorded into dictionaries, etc., by Dr. Johnson and other people via consciousness, and therefore dictionaries are always inaccurate because consciousness is always inaccurate. When we speak of the two words as human, we're talking about consciousness. Consciousness will tell you the laws of motion by which you ride a bicycle. And they can be perfectly recorded. They are Newton's laws. And yet, knowing consciously the laws of motion will not enable you to ride the bicycle. You will fall off. So how do you learn to ride a bicycle? Well, you experiment and you mess about and go on until you do. Now you know how to ride a bicycle. You're aware how to ride it. But you are unconscious of the laws of motion via which you operate. The cat is a marvelous animal. It has tremendous awareness, tremendous abilities to do what appears to be impossible, to be dropped from a height, from upside down, and land on his feet. And I think somebody recently proved that a bumblebee couldn't fly. There was no scientific way that a bumblebee could possibly remain airborne. It was much too heavy for its wingspan. Coming back to words, we have to go back to the history of words and their origin to discover what they really mean. We have to go back to what is called their etymology, the science of their origins. And somebody once said to me, "Do you know the etymology of etymology?" Who knows the etymology of etymology? If you have a German equivalent for it, we can do it in German. But it's probably the same word in German because it comes from the Greek. All right? What does it mean? Yes? It's beautiful. The etymology of etymology is, roughly translated, the true meaning. The etymology of a word is its true meaning. Its true meaning. What it really means. We cannot know what words mean without going to the true meaning, without looking at their history, discovering their origins. These are the true meanings of the word. I've lost the thread again. What were we talking about? What? Oh, yes. Right, materialism. What does it mean? Material? What is the origin? Yeah, the mother, yes. I'm sorry I can't do this in German, but you'll just have to put up with it in English. From mater, the Latin mater, we have material, matter, matrix, a mattress, what you lie on, mattress. Your mattress is a mother. But the wonderful thing is materialism. Motherism is what it is. Motherism. That is the true meaning of materialist, a motherist. A motherist. And so, that sets us looking around. Okay. What about paterialism? Paterialism, coming from pater, the father. Oh, you don't have such a word. Very strange. Never mind, let's pass over that. There are far fewer words from pater than from mater. One of them is pattern. Pattern is from pater. And so, we begin to see what's going on here. The mother is the matter, the matrix, the mattress, the material, And the Father is the pattern. And I thought of looking about here and saying, well, let's invent the word paterialism. Well, let's now consider now what a materialist, what is the view of a materialist? What does a materialist say? Anybody? What is his view of the world?
Because everything is made up just of matter. Nothing but matter.
Yes, yes. We have wonderful words, yes. When we say to somebody, we say, what is the matter? Meaning, what is wrong? Where do you feel the pain? We never think of saying, what is the mind? What is the mind? Why don't we say, what is the mind? Well, there's a wonderful poem by Andrew Marvell. Called A Dialogue Between the Soul and the Body, and I can't remember it as a poem exactly, but what happens is the body and the mind the soul and the body, roughly speaking the mind and the body, are having this argument, and the soul is saying, here I am, a prisoner, manacled in hands, fettered in feet, here blinded with an eye, there deaf with the drumming of an ear. And all the time the soul is longing for to be set free and says, when at last the body gets ill, and I think, at last I shall be set free. I'm shipwrecked into health again. And so it goes on. It's a beautiful poem. Well, it's not a very beautiful poem. It's a rather dull as a poem. But it's beautifully philosophical. And materialist scientist is saying that all that exists is matter, the mother. It's very interesting because, you see, material existence is the only existence where there's pain. And that is why we say, what is the matter? What is the pain? The whole of material existence is painful. It is the only existence in which enlightenment is possible, because enlightenment is like a fluid which is so corrosive that it will dissolve any vessel in which it is put. I remember Ronnie used to say, oh, why do we have to come to this painful existence, this terrible thing where people do terrible things to one another and so on and so forth? It is necessary. The gods are not enlightened. If they were, it would destroy them at once. We have to go through seven levels of existence, the material being the seventh, the most awful, the most painful. Because this is the only level where nothing has stabilized itself into this apparent solidity, which is so gross and so apparently stable that it can contain enlightenment without immediately being destroyed by it. And part of this poem says, the soul is saying to the body, I who I'm unable to feel pain. I'm made to suffer your pain by being imprisoned in you. So now we see what a materialist is a motherist. So what would be a paterialist? Materialist basically says, the only reality is matter. All else is unreal. Okay? Come on, now what does the paterialist say?
Maybe form is more basic than content.
Yes, but let's get something more nearly close to the opposite of what I've just said. Well, consider the father a pattern, the form, the spirit. We can speak in an analogical terms. I wrote a poem once which says, I am heaven, you are earth. Each of us has equal birth. Heaven above is what we know, but all things come through earth below. The father is representative of the spiritual. So the paterialist will say, only the spirit is real, all else is unreal. Now, do we have any people who say that? Of course, yes. One particular sect says that quite openly. The religion of Mary Baker Eddy, Christian Science. Only the spiritual is real, physical matter is unreal. And so they do fit the bill of my new word, paterialism. They are paterialists. And they carry their paterialism to a very great they carry it to extremes. And indeed, you see, the modern concern with the mother is quite recent, because you go back to the Middle Ages and it was spiritual, you see. They were more paterialists than materialists. But the religion of Christian Science is a beautifully exact example of the opposite of materialism. And in fact, it cost me a job with AT&T Bell, because the engineer who was interested in some of my circuits in Chapter 11 of Laws of Form wanted to produce some very fast counters, counting machines in hardware, computer equipment. And before he had time to sign the contract, he caught pneumonia, and he happened to be a Christian Scientist. And strict Christian Scientists are not allowed to treat the body. They're only allowed to pray if somebody gets ill. And everybody prayed, and he died. Whereas all he needed was penicillin. And you ask me if I'm a materialist or a paterialist. I'm neither, because I'm not any kind of ist. Ists are extremes. Ists are characterizations which blind you to any other description. Somebody once said to me, what are your theories? I have no theories. Because there are an infinite number of ways of describing anything. There are an infinite number of theories which will explain it. And as you see, I mean, I can explain things one way or another. There are an infinite number of ways of proving a mathematical theorem. All these are descriptions. And again, this is very nice indeed. Because what is a mathematical theorem other than the descriptions we make of it? What happens if we take away all the forms of description? Do we have a theorem left? Do we? No, there's nothing left. Nothing left at all. And these materialists who say only matter exists are still messing about with calculators and using numbers and writing down numbers and doing calculations. And I say to them, well, where are these numbers? What material objects are these numbers? You say they're only material objects. Well, come on, show me a number. Is there one under the carpet there? Do you have a number behind your chair anywhere? Are you sitting on one? Well, where are these numbers? Are they material objects? Anybody? Is a number a material object?
This is not any problem for modern materialists. They say they are abstract objects.
Bollocks to that. They are not material objects. And yet some numbers exist and some don't. The even prime, greater than 2, does not exist. It was proved that every number can be represented as the sum of 9 cubes. Most numbers need much fewer. What are the two numbers that need the complete complement of 9 cubes as a sum? Nobody knows? They are 23 and 239. And if you discover you cannot represent either 23 or 239 in less than 9 cubes. It is now known that these are the only numbers that exist that need the full complement of 9 cubes. So, the even prime greater than 2 does not exist. The numbers which do need the full complement of 9 cubes for their partition do exist. Some numbers do exist, others don't. So we have existence, which applies to numbers, but they're not material objects. They're not material objects. And so the very materialist who says only material objects are real, nevertheless, uses numbers and knows that some numbers do exist and some numbers do not. So that if they do not exist as a material object, either he must say, he must revise his materialism. What is he going to say? What's your name again? What's your name? What?
Thomas.
Thomas, the twin, yes, yes. What's he going to say? It's no good saying they're abstract objects. I mean, he's very close to spiritualism now, isn't he? Because, you see, his philosophy is that only material objects are real. So what's he got to say? Numbers are not real? Numbers are not real? But of course they are real. Except that we use words in a different way with numbers. We have what we call real numbers, and then we have what we call imaginary numbers. What is an imaginary number? It's a number that mathematicians used to feel very guilty about using and never let on they were doing so. And basically, imaginary number is the square root of minus 1. Now, I won't go through the thing. It's in the introduction to the American edition of Laws of Form. It is how I explained it to Russell, how I explained that we didn't need his theory of types. I wrote him a letter, and in fact, that letter is basically the introduction to the American edition of Laws of Form, where I show that if you just take it that there are only three kinds of number, there are negative numbers, positive numbers, and zero, you cannot get any equation with an imaginary number to work out, because what happens is that if you're taking a square root of minus 1, and if it's minus 1, it's plus 1, and if it's plus 1, it's minus 1. And so you have what would appear to be an oscillatory condition. I do the same thing in Laws of Form. I produce the feeding back of the answer of an expression into the expression itself, and if you feed it back through an even number of crosses, you get real roots, and if you feed through an odd number, you can get an oscillatory condition. If it's one thing, it isn't; it's the other. And that is the square root of minus 1. If it's minus 1, it's plus 1, and if it's plus 1, it's minus 1. And, of course, Russell Whitehead produced this law saying, we mustn't talk like this. And this pervaded all the philosophers and the logicians. And as Miller once said to me, logicians do logic because they can't do mathematics. And I said this to D.H. Lamer. And he said, well, of course it's true, but don't tell me I said so, because some of my best friends are logicians. And philosophers are philosophers because they can't do mathematics. And because mathematics is concerned with certainties. What you know. And the trouble with this thing, you see, is that it produces this contradiction. But we learned how to deal with it in mathematics. And so we don't mind it anymore. We used to feel very guilty. Well, they used to feel very guilty about it 200 years ago. And it was only considered as a trick, like masturbation, you know. You didn't tell anybody you did it. You got results, but you didn't. You kept quiet about how you got them, you see. And then it became respectable. And so I went to see Russell and to explain that I didn't need his theory of types anymore, and I thought he might be quite cross about this. In fact, he was delighted. And he said, I'm glad to have lived long enough to see this matter resolved, because I was never happy with the theory of types. It was just a stopgap, because we put it in because we didn't know how to deal with these things, and therefore we forbade anybody to talk about them. Just like they do at home. They forbid the children to talk about sex, you see, thinking that if that happens it will go away. Of course it doesn't. It just gets distorted. And we're talking about why Wittgenstein was wrong, aren't we? Yes, I keep losing the thread. It's been a long set of sessions, and I'm beginning to lose my magic now. I'm beginning to become quite ordinary. What Wittgenstein failed to realize, because Wittgenstein was a materialist, there's no doubt about that. He says towards the end, as you all know, the proper way to do philosophy would be to make only scientific statements. And then when anybody made a statement which was unscientific, simply to show where how he was wrong. But what he meant was material scientific statements. The whole idea of the book is a very beautiful book. It taught me a great deal. Death is not an experience in life. Death is not lived through. Now, this is something that is obvious and yet surprising. But throughout the book, he is himself trying to answer a question which is not a real question. Another thing, Wittgenstein said, if a question can be asked, it can be answered. And that is wonderful. Of course it's obvious. But like everything is obvious, it's the last thing you think of. I mean, what I wrote in Laws of Form is perfectly obvious once it's been thought of. But it's the last thing, you know. I 3 years of struggle to get there. The most obvious is the last thing you come to. The last thing you think of.